Bandwidth for the Tech Guy on KFI Podcast is brought to you by DSL Extreme at DSLExtreme.com. Hi, this is Leo, and this is my KFI Podcast. This show originally aired on KFI AM 640 in Los Angeles on Saturday, July 8th, 2006. This is show 263.
KFI is a talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. It's 11:06. I'm Lisa Osborne, KFI News.
Thank you, Lisa. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. And a good Saturday morning to you. We talk high tech now from now to 2 in the afternoon on KFI and every Saturday and Sunday. That's a lot of time, you think, to be devoting to technology? Well, not really when you think about what technology includes. I mean, this isn't just a Windows show or a Mac or a Linux show. It's the internet. It's MP3 players. It's cell phones. It's home theater, your camcorder. It's even biotech. Anything that is changing in the world of technology, that's the subjects we cover on this show. You're invited to call with your questions and suggestions. 1-800-520-1KFI. I'm going to keep doing the show this afternoon after 2. Dina Dell comes on at 2 on the air, but I'm going to continue to take calls till at least 3:30. So please keep them coming in. 1-800-520-1KFI. I do this from time to time, and it's really great to get extra callers on the show. As usual, I'm going to start off talking a little bit about what's in the news, and there's a lot in the news today. I hardly even know where to start. One of the big stories is America Online. This is a story that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, so I have to give it some credibility. They're talking about giving away their services for free. They're talking about changing their entire business model, and I think it's a very interesting story. And, you know, initially you might say, well, how can a business survive by giving away for free something that they've been charging $26 a month for up to now? Well, there are a few little things that make this make more sense. First of all, not everything will be free. The real cost to AOL right now is it costs them a lot of money to be giving you dial-up. And so one of the things that AOL would really like to do is get rid of those dial-up users. They've mentioned this before, you know, the dial-up users are just killing them. So what they're thinking of doing is, if you have broadband, if you have high-speed internet, if you're buying, in other words, high-speed internet from another provider, DSL Extreme or your cable company or SBC, Yahoo, you'd get AOL for free. If you're dialing in using AOL's modems, that's the biggest cost to them, you'd continue to have to pay. So what would you get for free? Well, let's say you have broadband already and you want to use AOL. You'd get their software. You'd get their email. You'd get the entire service absolutely free, the stuff that they're charging a lot of money for. You'd still be paying for your high-speed internet, and that's kind of the key to this. They've had for a while a plan called Bring Your Own Access, and that's what this is essentially. And that I think was, what, $8, $9, $10 a month? If you already had an internet service provider, you could keep AOL for a relatively small fee. That's what they're considering eliminating. The deal is they're losing subscribers. In the first quarter of this year, they had 18.6 million subscribers, but that was down 3 million from a year earlier. Revenue was down 7%. Subscription revenue down 13%. But watch this number. Advertising revenue went up 26%. Ah, now a light bulb goes on. This makes sense. Increasingly, AOL's business is eyeballs, not subscription dollars. They want to hold on to those subscribers because they're valuable to AOL for advertising. According to the plan, this is a plan, according to the Wall Street Journal, presented by their CEO, Jonathan Miller, they would expect to lose about 8 million dial-up subscribers. But that's okay with them. It costs them a lot. They'd love to get rid of those guys. And I presume that there's another side of the plan where they would gain new subscribers, people who would just use AOL's services because they're free. I think it has a little bit to do with net neutrality as well. I think companies like AOL and Google who are threatened. Now, we've talked about net neutrality before. I'm gonna change the name to net discrimination because I think it's confusing. What we're against is discrimination from internet service providers like Verizon, Yahoo, SBC, or I guess they call themselves AT&T now, don't they? Comcast. They're pushing very hard for a tiered system where some companies get better access to you than others. These big internet service providers really think of you as an asset. They're selling you. This is what AOL is saying, too. The real asset here is the subscribers. Not their subscription dollars, but their eyeballs. So what Comcast, Verizon, AT&T are thinking is, well, you know, Google makes a lot of money off of our subscribers. See, they think of us as their property, right? They make a lot of money off of our subscribers. We really ought to get a cut of that. They want to go to Google and say to Google, they want to go to AOL and say to AOL, hey, you're making a bunch of money off of our subscribers. You really ought to pay us for access. And if you don't, we'll go to somebody else. We'll go to your competitor and tell them the same thing. And if MSN says, yeah, we're willing to pay some money to get better access to your subscribers, we'll give them faster connections. And, you know, people will stop using Google or AOL because it'll be slower. This is the plan. So AOL, which is both, by the way, an internet service provider and a Google-type advertising vehicle, is basically turning their back on being an internet service provider. They're saying, well, you know, there's not enough money in that. We want to make our money as Google does in advertising, in delivering eyeballs. This is going to be a big battle. We're going to see a big battle. Google's going the other way, by the way. Increasingly, their evidence is pointing to the fact that Google is looking to become an internet service provider. Maybe it's defensive. It might have something to do with Google protecting itself in case the big internet service providers say, hey, you can't see our customers unless you pay us a little extra. Google is buying up what they call dark fiber, unused fiber optic cables underneath the entire country. They're building, in secrecy, network tiny network operation centers they can deploy very quickly. They're about the size of a dumpster. They are building a massive network operation center in the Dalles up in Oregon that they've kept secret. They've told everybody involved, you can't say the G word. All signs point to Google. And by the way, they're making deals. They started with the city of San Francisco to provide free wireless internet to cities. The pilot programs in San Francisco. So Google's definitely moving in the direction of becoming their own internet service provider. And I think it's defensive. If your cable company or your ISP, your Verizon or AT&T says to you, maybe they won't even say it to you. It says to Google, well, you know, you want to pay, you got to pay. If you want access to our customers, you got to pay. Google just says no. And then goes to you, the customers, and say, this is what's happening. And wouldn't you like free internet from us? We'll do it for free. I see this scenario happening, playing out in the next couple of years. Now, a couple of weeks ago, the Senate turned down an amendment to the telecommunications bill that would have guaranteed network neutrality. I'm not sure such a bad idea. It was a tie vote, 11-11, but they needed a majority to get this amendment in. The amendment was essentially saying you cannot discriminate against anybody. As an internet service provider, you can't say to anybody, we're going to make you slower, or say to anybody, we're going to make you faster. A bit is a bit. No discrimination on the internet. Probably a good idea. I don't know if it needs to be a law. In any event, the senators decided against it. The chairman of the committee is a third oldest guy in the Senate, Tent Stevens. He's from Alaska. And he is really essentially the spokesman for AT&T and the other big telcos. I played this on my podcast, and I thought it'd be interesting to play it for you. It's just a couple of minutes. It's a clip of Senator Stevens. Now, this guy is very powerful. He's the guy who really torpedoed the idea of network neutrality, of non-discrimination on the net. He's the guy who is fostering the idea of the broadcast flag, which, by the way, did get added to the telecommunications bill. The broadcast flag would require any consumer electronics manufacturer that made a device that could play back digital television to put in a device that would allow the TV, the television maker, the content creator, HBO or whatever, to say, no, you can't copy this. Basically, copy protection in every single consumer electronic device. Built-in hardware copy protection. So that's in the bill, by the way. Not law yet. It's just in the bill. Thanks to this guy. Now, let me play this cut because I think it's very telling. This is Senator Stevens talking to his own committee about why the internet should not be protected against this kind of discrimination. And it's interesting to hear.
That started with a concept of local to local.
What his notion of the internet
the
is.
Country, and you could go for Air Alaska, but you had to go through local connections to get there. The industry wisely provided for.
This is not true, by the way. The internet wasn't local to local, but it was and still is a series of hops around the country. He's just basically spouting what AT&T says to say.
Streaming for, in effect, a new kind of long distance, and that's what we've got. We've got a service that's immune to distance.
Yeah. So he's saying that the big telcos, my clients, effectively, put in backbones, paid for the backbones. This is true. Sprint did it, MCI, AT&T, that carry most of the internet traffic coast to coast.
And it's there for the consumer. But when we take and really indicate that anyone that wants to use this system for massive commercial purposes, well, there's one company now.
By the way, this is the propaganda that AT&T and the others are putting out, saying, well, this is Google or Netflix. They're just going to use our bandwidth without paying for it. By the way, they're paying for it. They have big bandwidth bills. Trust me, they pay a lot for their internet access.
You can get sign up and you can get a movie delivered to your house daily.
He's talking about Netflix.
By subscription service, by delivery service, okay? And currently it comes to your house, it put in a mailbox when you get home, annually or monthly, you change your order. But you pay for that, right? This service is now going to go through the internet, and what you do is you just go to a place on the internet and you order your movie, and guess what? You can order 10 of them, and it's delivered to you, and this delivery charge is free, right?
This is not your crazy grandpa. This is one of the most powerful men in the Senate, and the guy who is really, in many ways, determining telecommunications policy for the entire country. And he doesn't really seem to understand how the internet works.
10 movies streaming across that internet, and what happens to your own personal internet? I just the other day got internet was sent by my staff at 10 o'clock in the morning on Friday. I got it yesterday. Why? Because it got tangled up with all of these things that are going on the internet commercially.
Oh, no, I'm not even going to comment on that. When we come back, one more little clip from Senator Ted Stevens. His explanation of how the internet works. And I'll tell you, I don't know. He may be a wonderful senator for the state of Alaska. I know he is. He's managed to get a lot of pork barrel spending in Alaska. He's built a famous bridge to nowhere in Alaska on the government's dime, our taxpayers' money. And now he's doing everything he can to make sure AT&T gets exactly what it wants in the Senate. But does he understand what he's talking about? Apparently not. Wait till you hear his explanation of how the internet works. That's coming up in a bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
When you see breaking news, don't try to fix it. Call the professionals in the KFI News Department. 323-CALL-KFI.
1127, KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. 1-800-520-1KFI is the number. I just want to wrap this up with Senator Stevens because the best is, I saved the best for last. Senator Stevens, Alaska chairman, it's the Senate Commerce and Science and Technology Committee, something like that. But essentially, it's the Telecommunications Committee. He's talking about the telecommunications bill and why we don't need protection on the internet. Basically spouting AT&T's point of view and Verizon, why we've got to charge big companies like Netflix and Google more extra. Now, they're already paying for their bandwidth. He apparently doesn't understand that. They pay a lot of money for their bandwidth. But he said, but what he really is doing is he's a spokesman for the telcos who want to charge him extra on the other end. They want to get him coming and going. They essentially want to charge him for access to you and me. Here is his explanation.
And here we have this one situation
of how the internet works.
Enormous entities want to use the internet for their purpose to save money for doing what they're doing now.
The enormous entities here he's talking about are not AT&T and Verizon. They're AOL, Google, Netflix, people, Amazon, you and me, podcasters, people who use the internet to distribute content. That's the enormous entities he's talking about, not the even more enormous entities of AT&T, Verizon, SBC, that kind of people.
They use FedEx. They use the delivery services. They use the mail. They deliver in other ways, but they want to deliver vast amounts of information over the internet.
Yes, that's what it was made for. And we want them to do it, don't we?
It's not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes. And if you don't understand, those tubes can be filled. And if they're filled, when you put your message in, it gets in line.
This is the fundamental problem here. He says the internet is not a big truck. It's a series of tubes. And if the tubes get filled, your message won't get through. Huh?
It's going to be delayed by anyone that puts into that tube enormous amounts of material.
I don't buy it. Sorry, Senator. All right, we are going to go to your phone calls. I'd like to know what you think about this whole thing. I mean, I think that is the most telling speech of all. I didn't even really need to annotate it. I should just play it for you. This is the guy who's in charge of telecommunications in the Senate. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 11:29. Let's head to the KFI News Center. Ladies and gentlemen, there has been a change in the offer from DSL Extreme, and I want you to listen very closely because this is important. If you are paying a whole lot for your high-speed internet, if you're paying more than, let's say, $12.95 a month for your high-speed internet, you're paying too much. DSL Extreme, my internet service provider, offers high-speed internet for just $12.95 a month, and the first month is free. There's no setup charge. There's no charge for the modem. Tech support's free. But here's the change. This offer for the free month ends Monday, July 17th. So for the best deal, you need to act right now. I use DSL Extreme. I love them. And I know you will, too. And boy, at this price, there's no reason to pay more. If you're on dial-up, this is probably less than you're paying for dial-up. You don't need a second phone line. That'll save you money right there. But hurry up and call now. $12.95 a month is the lowest price in the country for DSL. And if you call right now, you get your first month of service free. But that free month offer expires Monday, July 17th. Some restrictions do apply. Call 866-2-GET-NET. That's 866-2-GET-NET. Or visit them online at dslextreme.com. High-speed internet for $12.95 a month. And your first month is free, but only for the next couple of weeks. Call 866-2-GET-NET to get DSL Extreme.
Live streaming 24/7, KFI, AM640.com.
KFI, AM640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Enough of Senator Stevens. I thought it's really important for people to hear what our senators sound like. And I hope the people in Alaska who elected this clown are listening. And what is really a shame is that, you know, the internet, the future of the internet is in his hands. That's what's really scary. Now, I think in the long run, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Google and AOL and other companies that have a huge vested interest in keeping the internet the way it is, I hope that they will. I don't worry about Google or AOL. I worry more about podcasters. And, there's this whole fledgling group of people doing audio and video for the internet who, in fact, do use a lot of bandwidth. And it's great for them. It's a chance. It's a form of distribution that gives them a huge opportunity to express themselves. And that's what I worry about because, you know, speaking as a podcaster, there's no way we could afford to, we're already paying huge amounts for bandwidth. There's no way we could afford to pay more to get access to you. It's just not going to happen. It's not massive, giant companies. They can protect themselves. I'm not worried about Google and Netflix and AOL. It's you and me. It's Ask a Ninja. It's Rocket Boom. It's people like that. That's who is at risk if we allow discrimination on the internet. Let's get to the phones from Los Angeles. Charlize, our first caller of the day. Hello, Charlize. Welcome to KFI.
Hi, Leo.
What can I do for you today?
Am I on?
You're on, my friend.
My name is Charles. I thought you said Charlize.
It's just a typo.
I'm slow today. Leo.
No, it's not your fault. It's a typo on the call screen.
Oh, it is. Okay.
All right, Charles. What can I do for you?
I'm 53 years old. I'm from the 60s, and there was always a guy like Senator Stevens
always
in the Senate railing about something. Yep. I mean, this year it's about the internet, but it either was about haircuts or loud music
yes,
or something.
Yes.
Right?
No, you're absolutely right. It's good to have a sense of history. The Senate has always been full of, you know, the Strom Thurmonds of the world who just don't get it.
Yeah, there you go.
I just don't want this guy determining internet policy for years to come.
Yeah, especially when he doesn't understand it.
It's a series of tubes.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
I wanted to ask you, about a month ago, a guy called up and said, should I wait for Conray? And you said, well, not unless you're doing like video and stuff like that.
Now it's time to wait because Conroe and Merrim, the laptop versions of Conroe, are coming out now.
Oh, they are?
Next month or so. And
My question was going to be, I'm a musician. In fact, I'm the world's oldest rapper. I'm all over Google. If you Google white man rapping, you'll see me Google it and you'll see a clip of me with Steve Harvey doing. I look like Albert Brooks and I do like LL Cool J.
I love it. So you're a Vanilla Ice for baby boom generation.
Google white man rapping, not .com, and you'll see. Click on Steve Harvey and you'll see me in front of a. Okay, it was on national TV. Anyway, okay, enough of that. So I'm going to be running like Pro Tools and stuff. So Conray is going to be a better bet.
I think for you, yeah, I do. I think it'll probably. You'll probably do a little bit better with something like that.
Okay.
And the reason I say it's worth waiting is because it's coming out now. Now, they don't call it Conroe. They call it Core 2.
Oh.
Core 2. It's the Conroe and Merrim are the code names.
Uh-huh.
But Core 2 is the Intel name. So if you look now, you'll start seeing companies advertising.
Will I see Mac coming out with it too?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Everybody seems to think that that's what Apple's been waiting for in their towers. So you use Pro Tools on Windows or Mac?
I'm just buying my computer. That's why I'm calling.
You probably want to use Mac. I'm not sure you want to use Pro Tools, but there are many good choices out there.
I'll probably end up using like Cubase or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're better choices. My friend Ash, who's a professional composer and is in our chat room, in fact, that might be a place to go, Charles, to ask this question. Tried like the devil to discourage me from buying Pro Tools. I did, and then I wish I had listened to him. There are other choices that, depending on what you're doing, will probably be better.
Well, more bang for the buck, anyway.
Can I play this cut from the Dave Chappelle show?
What's that?
This is you. This is him rapping.
That's it.
So you do imitations of different rappers, or what's the deal?
I actually rap, too. I was just on that Jamie Kennedy MTV show. I actually rap, too, but they wouldn't let me on that show. But, there's more to come, you know?
All right, Charles. Well, good luck with your musical career.
Leo, can I ask you one more question?
The world's oldest white rapper, yes.
Yeah, 53 years old. You know, could I do all this stuff on a Samsung Q1?
What is the Samsung Q1?
That little handheld thing with the Windows XP that, you know, like just came out.
Oh, that one, yeah. I wouldn't.
Okay.
See, now you're asking the kind of the opposite question, which is, can I get away with a low and slow thing? The Q1 is one of these UMPCs that Microsoft's been putting out, and I don't know what the processor is, but it's sure ain't a Conroe.
Before the Pentium.
Oh, the Celeron. Okay,
it's a Celeron.
No. Yeah, I wouldn't want to do it on that.
All right, Leo,
mainly because you want faster. You want faster hard drives, and you want faster RAM. Both of those are more important to you.
Thanks, Leo.
My pleasure, Charles. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for the airtime there.
All right, my pleasure.
Right,
and yeah, thanks. I'll play a little more. this is Charles on the Dave Chappelle show doing. Oh no, we missed it. But you can find it on the internet. You can find anything on the internet, right? Is actually his real name. I don't know why I use Charles. His real name is apparently Steve. Unless I'm very confused here. Starting to feel like Ted Stevens a little bit. Let's go to Jeff. Jeff in Miami. Welcome to KFI, Jeff. How you doing, Jeff?
Hey, hi, Leo.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'll try to make it quick. Leo, I'm kind of stuck using Windows and IE because of programs and plugins that I'm dependent on. And at home and at the office, I'm behind routers. But I'm not sure what and how many antivirus and anti-spyware programs I should keep running in my system.
How many do I need to be safe?
Yeah, I mean, I know it uses up cycles.
I do. And, you know,
and I remember you saying something about it's good to have more than one something and not necessary to have more than one of the other. And I
yes.
don't remember whether it was spyware or anti-spyware
good.
Or antivirus.
Well, I'm glad you called for a clarification because there is a difference. You shouldn't have more than one antivirus running in the background. You can own more than one antivirus, but just only one at a time should be running in the background. They conflict with each other. So, for instance, when you buy Nod32 or Norton or McAfee, they all have components that will check your email as it comes in. You know, they're always watching for virus activity. That's one part of them. The other part is a scanner. And that could just sit there on your hard drive and just run once in a while. For instance, you probably would run that weekly. In that case, those you can have as many scanners as you want. They don't conflict with each other. They run independently, one after the other. But you don't want both McAfee and Norton and Nod32 all trying to grab your email at the same time, all watching for virus activity at the same time, because they will conflict with each other. So generally...
Counterspy keeps locking up on some semantic file.
Yeah, well, and this is another issue because many of them, I don't know if this is anti-competitive or what, but many of them say the other guy's a spy program or a virus program. I think it's probably because of the way that they work. So generally speaking, you want to minimize the number of things that are running in the background. One good antivirus running in the background, watching for virus-like activity, what I would recommend is the Windows Defender. That's the Microsoft free anti-spyware program. That has something called real-time protection. And that can run at the same time as an antivirus. Those two things running in the background. But then you can have as many other things as you want to scan periodically because they're not conflicting with each other.
Okay.
It's the stuff that's all running at the same time that's problematic.
Yes.
So what I recommend is Windows Defender running in the background. That's free. That's for your spyware. And then a good antivirus. Now, my experience with Norton and McAfee both is that they're heavy duty. They weigh down the system. They slow it down 10-15%. And they're not particularly effective. So generally, I recommend something like Nod32. The reason I started recommending Nod32 before they were an advertiser, and I should disclaim that they are an advertiser now on the show, but the reason I liked them from the beginning was lightweight and effective. And so you're looking for something like that. Otherwise, your system just starts to run like molasses. And then you also should have a router.
Yeah, I'm behind routers on both places.
And that basically is your firewall.
Okay.
All right?
Thanks.
Hey, thank you for the call, Jeff. I appreciate it. Recently, actually, it's an interesting story. On the Mac, there's a program called Little Snitch, which is real. I wish there was something like Little Snitch for the Windows side. It's not exactly a firewall. It's doing probably the most important thing of a software firewall, which is looking at outbound connection attempts. It's keeping an eye on what's trying to get out. And that's the reason to run a software firewall. Windows firewall does not do it, but something like I recommend the Carrio personal firewall. I generally don't recommend software firewalls because, again, that's something else running in the background. The more stuff you got running constantly, the slower your machine is. But Little Snitch proved its worth this week when it caught a widget, an Apple widget, that was phoning home. It was checking back with Apple to look for updates. Now, as it turns out, that's fairly benign. In fact, most computers check with the operating system company to see if there's an update. But I think it's good that the people are running this program, Little Snitch. They're watching. And when they see something phoning home, they say, hey, Microsoft got in a lot of trouble for Windows Genuine Advantage checking home every day. And they've agreed to back off. Apple's agreed to turn off this regular checking that this widget does for the same reason. So that is a good reason to have something running in the background, watching outbound connections. And you know, I wish there were something lightweight like Little Snitch that you could run on a piece. There probably is. I'm sure somebody will call and tell me. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 1148.
The Jesus Christ Show, tomorrow morning, 6 to 9 a.m., KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
1156, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. KFI, 1-800-520-1KFI. Richard's on the line from Yorba Linda. Hello, Richard. Welcome to KFI.
Thank you, Leo. I just want to, well, I have a question, but before I ask it, I just want to remind you of what Will Rogers observed about 75 years ago. We have the best politicians money can buy.
Yeah. I guess it's always been a problem. It seems like it's worse. I mean, it's certainly true that any senator or member of Congress today spends almost all of his or her time raising money.
Yeah, well, you know, once they get their nose in the
public trough,
you know, it's hard to get it out.
It is, and it's really a shame. In a way, that's why I'm generally against any government regulation of the internet at all. And so the whole idea of a law promoting net neutrality always made me a little bit nervous.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I got a question for you. I bought a Canon 3IS, nice camera.
Yeah,
and it has a panorama feature.
Yeah.
That you can take panorama pictures. But of course, with any camera taking panorama pictures, you have to know where the nodal point or exit pupil is, and to rotate the camera around that point.
Right.
Well, I called technical support and talked to someone who had no idea what a nodal point was or what panorama was. Well, he knew panorama, but he didn't know what parallax was.
Right.
And so I gave up on him. And I talked to another guy who said he had some understanding, but he wouldn't tell me where the nodal points were. And so I said, okay. So I emailed their technical support, and I got an email back from them saying, unfortunately, we do not have this type of specifications
because
we do not support nodal points on this camera, a camera that they specifically tout as.
Well, I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why, Richard. You're a little more sophisticated than the average user. When these kinds of cameras promote this panoramic capability, really, it's not a high-quality panorama as you're looking for. It's stitched together images. So you do get this weird kind of distortion look to it because they're not rotating around a node. You're just taking a picture, moving it over, taking a picture, moving it over. And the stitching software that's either built into the camera or comes with the camera will match edges. That's all it's doing.
Yeah, well, the problem is that you get parallax error.
Absolutely. In fact, if you've ever looked at one of these consumer panoramas, they look bizarre.
That's true.
They don't look like real life because of this error. But when they say panorama, that's what they're meaning. If you want something that's more sophisticated, that's probably not, you know, the camera for you.
Well, the thing is, if we could find the nodal point, then it would take perfect panoramas.
Now, how do you know the nodal point is based on the curvature of the lens? How would you determine the nodal point?
First of all, the people who design the lens would know.
They ought to know.
And they could easily tell me how far down the shaft of the lens the nodal point is. As a matter of fact, I'm an optometrist, and I can figure.
That's why you know that. Because,
well, I know how to figure it,
right.
And it's not too tough to figure the wide angle. In fact, I've already figured that, and it works perfectly that way. But the problem is, it's got a 12x telephoto, and if you want to take panoramas, you use the telephoto.
I want to talk a little bit more about this because I'm not familiar with this, and I would like you to explain a little bit more as somebody who's an expert in lenses. So let's take a break for news and hang on the line, if you would, Richard, because I'd like to know a little bit more about this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 1159. It's time to head to the KFI News Center right now.
Sunny, high 70s at the beaches, 80s and 90s for metro LA and Orange counties, up to 106 in the valleys. It's 81 right now in Los Alamitos, 81 in Huntington Beach, 90 in Glendale, and 76 in Santa Monica. KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. At 12:07, I'm Jessica Rosenthal, KFI News.
Thank you, Jessica. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. 1-800-520-1KFI is my phone number. I'm going to keep the phones going through at least 3 or 3:30 this afternoon. We're taping ahead, so keep those calls coming in, even after Dean Adell joins us at 2 this afternoon. I also want to remind you the website is available online. Just go to KFIAM640.com. You'll get all our show notes, all the links and so forth. Ted Stevens' full speech, if you want to hear the whole kit and caboodle and all that, at KFIAM640.com. Click the official website link on my page. And you get to my page by hovering your mouse over shows and clicking my name. The official website is leo.am. And you can just go there, and this is show 263. Yes, that's right, 263 for Saturday, July 8th. So you'll find all the details there. Now, well, very interesting conversation about something that I didn't know much about. So I'm actually glad to talk to somebody who understands these things. It turns out that Richard in Yorba Linda is an optometrist, so he knows about lenses. He bought a Canon camera. Wanted to take panoramas. It advertised panorama capability. But when he called Canon and said, what's the nodal point of the lens on this camera? They said, what's the wahahwa? Hanaha? And now, explain to me why that's important. And by the way, just to reiterate what I said, the reason that they say panorama is most people don't care about nodal points. They just use the built-in stitching software to match edges, and then you get this wide picture. But as Richard pointed out, the picture is distorted because you're not paying attention to parallax. So what is the nodal point and why is that important, Richard?
Well, I think you just sort of summed it all up very well. It is the nodal point itself is the axis of rotation that you need to use to avoid parallax distortion.
Okay. So it's not the center point of the lens. It's actually somewhat distant behind the lens, right?
Well, that's the thing. These aren't just single lenses. These are combinations of maybe 5 to 10 lenses.
That's how they do the zoom?
Yeah, that's right. So there's it's not necessarily inside the lens. Sometimes the nodal point or exit pupil, those two things are very close together, it's either, sometimes it can be way outside the lens, in front of it, could be in back of it. It's just no way to know just by looking at it. You have to figure it. That's the best way. But, of course, they're not going to give you the specification of the lenses.
Well, and it's very hard to figure probably on a zoom like this where you have so many different lenses. It's probably not a simple calculation.
Well, actually, you take I can tell you how to do it, really. By taking all the lenses as one lens for the wide angle, it's really very easy. It just requires you to have a small lazy Susan.
You got to rotate it, right? Yeah.
And you mark the center of the lazy Susan, and then you put the camera somewhere on the with the lens on the center of the lazy Susan. Look through the viewfinder or the little television and have a pencil maybe 2 feet in front, standing up, 2 feet in front of the lens, and then a target, another pencil maybe 10 feet away. And you move the camera around with the lazy Susan rotating it around a certain point and see if one pencil stays in line with the other. If it doesn't, you move the camera a little back or a little forward until when you're moving the camera like 15 degrees to the right, 15 degrees to the left, the pencils stay lined up. At that point, wherever the center of that lazy Susan is, that's where the center of the rotation is, or the nodal point.
So that's where you would put the tripod or whatever you're using to hold the camera as you rotate it, so that it would rotate around that axis.
Yeah, of course, they never put the little screw hole for the tripod there, but there are things called pano heads, which allow you to do that. But you can do that by hand fairly easily. The problem is, with this camera, it has a 12x zoom, and it's almost impossible to figure it that, on that thing. And the big deal about panoramic pictures is not what you think, or what most people think. It's not to take 3 or 4 pictures of a mountainscape.
Yeah, see, that's why I was wondering, because why would you even use the zoom? Why don't you use the wide angle?
There's the thing. Because you can take using this, this is a 6-megapixel camera, but with that camera, I can take 100-megapixel pictures by simply taking, say, a row of 4 and another row of 4 and another row of 4, one on top of the other, you know, like
right.
15 or 20 pictures, and stitch them all together, top and bottom, and into one picture, and now it's 20 times 6 megapixels, and that's
it's a high resolution image.
Yeah, a real high resolution picture.
What are you taking pictures of?
Some around the edges, but
right.
You can. There's a fellow, I don't know who should mention his name, but
go ahead,
Max Lyons. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of him?
No, uh-uh.
Oh, got to go to his website. He has taken pictures that are hundreds and hundreds of megapixels. They are gorgeous pictures, and they're indistinguishable from a camera. You can't buy a camera that takes
no, that's higher resolution. That's right. That's higher resolution than any film camera.
He has taken pictures that you can't tell the difference between
wow.
that picture that was taken, and he takes it with a Canon D4, I think it is.
Now, so to do that accurately, obviously, you'd need to know the nodal point. I mean, you couldn't possibly do that without that.
And that's the problem, and I can't imagine why they're being hidden about that, or not hidden, but they're so
they don't know.
Secretive about that.
I don't think they know. Nobody's asked him ever.
Someone does. I mean, there's got to be someone who designed the lens.
That guy knows, but no,
yeah, but the
nobody
thing,
else
they won't
does.
Let you talk to any of the
right.
engineers. I tried that.
Well, let's see if we can find out. We have some connections at Canon. I'll see if we can find out.
Big enough to be able to get in and because they probably consider it proprietary. But the thing is,
it's not really.
Reality is, a person can buy this camera for $300 or $400 and take it apart and find out
right.
everything they need to know.
If the competition
so sure,
wants that information, they can get it.
What's that?
If the competition wanted that information,
oh,
they
absolutely,
can get it.
They can. Well, Olympus or Kodak or someone can easily buy one of these cameras
right,
and reverse
right.
engineer it. So it's not a big deal.
Richard, what are you taking 100 megapixel images of?
Well, actually, nothing worthwhile, but I've done it, and it works. There's no question about it.
Interesting.
In fact, I have a friend who teaches Photoshop, and I sent him about a 40-megapixel picture,
wow.
and I said, here, tell me all about this. And he put it in Photoshop and dissected it, and he called me right back and said, how did you get a 40-megapixel picture? Because the detail is exquisite.
Oh, I bet it is. Oh,
now,
it is.
From what I understand, the best your eye can do is about 230 megapixels.
So it's right at the edge of what the eye can perceive.
Yeah, but Max Lyons has a picture that's 1,000 megapixels.
Wow.
But, of
wow.
course, on the Internet, he doesn't, you know, it would
you can't
take up
download
a,
it, yeah.
Yeah, it would
yeah.
take up everything. But
so that's why you need the zoom, because
really
otherwise, this would be a giant image. A zoom would mean you could make an image of a person's face that was... That
That's right.
Resolution.
You want the smallest possible area
right.
And make a lot of pictures, take a lot of pictures of a small area and then stitch them all together and you'll get an exquisitely fine, sharp picture.
Well, you've given me a great idea for a segment on our next Mac Break. So let me see if what we can do on researching this, because I think that would be that's a fascinating little hobby. I could see why, especially on something like the 3IS, which is really not a pro camera. They're not gonna maybe even know that information, or at least nobody at any normal level that you could communicate with would know that information, because they don't expect anybody to want to know it.
If you don't know it, you're gonna take really crummy pictures.
yeah. Well, most people don't care. Now, if you went out and you bought a 5D or something, I think that they probably could tell you that.
Well, I'll bet they wouldn't. I'll bet they keep that proprietary as well.
Well,
I mean, if they're not going to tell you about a crummy camera, they're certainly
right.
not going to tell you about their good one.
Right. Well, let me do some research, see if we can find out. I have put a link in the show notes to a site that kind of explains this with pictures, because I know it's a little hard to understand what we're talking about. But in fact, it's something I had never really thought of. I mean, every time I've done a panorama, I've noticed this parallax distortion. It just gives you a weird... You know, everything looks kind of bent, and I never thought you could get around it. But what a neat way. I mean, if you made a panorama that was a true panorama, that there was no distortion, it would be spectacular. And what a neat way to make a very high-resolution image, too. So thank you, Richard, for filling us in, and we'll see if we can find out more about it. And I think this would be a great segment on one of my TV shows, probably Mac Break. And we'll see if we can do some research and do it for you. 1217, Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
What do you get when you mix more stimulating talk radio to your weekends? Duh. More stimulating weekends.
1223 KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. And thank you for being so patient. Mark in Santa Ana, you're next on KFI.
Hey.
Hey, Mark.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And by the way, it's amazing because if anybody should be afraid, it should be people in Alaska who are stuck, you know, in the wintertime.
You're right.
And probably depend on internet. So it just goes to show how our representatives don't pay attention to what we really need. They
Not
just do whatever
the
they're
least.
Bought to paid to do.
Absolutely. And what I don't get is, and it's historically true, is why these guys keep getting reelected. Once you're the incumbent, it's pretty darn hard to get rid of you. And you'd think the folks in Alaska would be worried about this, but maybe not.
Yeah, I'd love to see him in a debate, babble on. But anyhow.
That would be cruel.
With lie detectors,
yes.
That ought to be a requirement.
Yes.
Anyhow, the question I had is I went online with Linksys and had a discussion on how to set up static IP addresses on the internal network.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I was wasting my time when I had to start... explaining what an internal and external IP address was.
Oh, dear.
And he kept wanting me to turn on the WAN addressing as static.
No.
I know.
Yeah.
I know better
yeah.
than that. But, I mean, I got to set this up in D-Link. Belk, just you can set up just, you know, the lease time is permanent.
Right.
But in Netgear, you can say, okay, take this MAC address, assign this IP address, and you're done. But I don't know how to do that on Linksys.
The first thing to do is, of course, is to turn off DHCP. Because DHCP is the address assigning protocol. So what you want to do is say, I'm not going to use DHCP. I'm going to do my own addresses. And frankly, that's really all you need to do. Once you turn that off, you disable the DHCP server. You can at that point say, well, here's at least on the Linksys, you'll say, here's the starting point. Here's the addresses I'm going to use. They all begin with 192.168.1. And you say, here's the starting IP address I'm going to use. And you just, from that point on, you go into your PCs and you give them static addresses, and that's it.
Oh, so you do it from the PC.
The PC, you give it an address. So currently the way it's set up is, this is the default, and it works for most people, is you tell the router, use DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. And that means that the router is going to assign, as soon as a computer logs in, as soon as it's turned on, and it says, hey, to the router says, hey, your number's 192.168.1.201. And the computer says, fine. And that's it. It's got now an address. You want it to have a static address for whatever reason. You don't want it to have a changing address. So you tell the router... here you go, router. Don't use DHCP. Turn off DHCP. You go into the computers, the Windows computers, and you say to them, don't ask the router. You don't need to ask the router. I'm going to tell you what you are. And you give it a static address. Now, it has to be in that range. So you have to tell that individual computer, okay, you'll do what the router was doing automatically, effectively. You are 192.168.1.201. You enter it into your Windows or your Mac or your Linux machine. You say, this is your address. This is your never-changing IP address. And that's it. It's actually really simple. I think you were probably making it more complicated than it was. If there's no issue of leasing because it keeps that address forever. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, there are a couple of reasons you want to do that. Most of the time, DHCP is preferred because, for instance, if somebody comes in your house with a laptop, they can get on your network. Because as soon as they open it up and either log into your Wi-Fi or plug in to the Ethernet port on your router, they'll be assigned an address. And it won't be an address that conflicts with anything else. As soon as you start assigning static, unchanging IP addresses, you, the administrator, are responsible for making sure there's no collisions. So you have to tell each machine an address, and they have to be unique. Each machine has to have its own local address. Again, beginning with 192.168.1.something. That's how it is with Linksys. With other routers, it might be 10.0.0.something or 10.0.1.something. These are all private internet addresses. Now, why would you want to do this? Well, a couple of reasons. One, let's say you're using port forwarding and you always want a certain kind of traffic to go to a certain computer. Well, if the computer doesn't use DHCP, its address will never change. It's a static means. It's not dynamic. It never changes. It also means that somebody can't just walk in and plug into your net. And that's why the router will say, well, where do you want your starting IP address to be? That gives you a modicum of security. I mean, they can, by trial and error, find an IP address that works. But during that trial and error, they may conflict with an existing machine, which would give you a little warning, because suddenly you'd see a little pop-up saying, somebody else is using this address. And you go, that's not right. So it gives you some security. There are probably other good reasons to do this. But for most of us, the way the router comes out of the box is fine. All you really, if you're turning on a router, all you really want to do is change the default name and default password. Turn off universal plug and play. And if it's a wireless router, turn on WPA encryption. And you're done. That's all you need to do. Change the name and password, because everybody knows what the defaults are. So change those. Turn off universal plug and play. If it's wireless, turn on WPA. If you have on your router a feature called LAN administration or WAN administration, the ability to administer the router externally from an external address, turn that off. Unless you know you need it, but most people don't. That allows somebody from outside your network to administer your router. You don't want that. So you want to disable that. And that's it. You're done. 1229, Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Jessica Rosenthal's in the KFI News Center.
Taken Southern California by storm. Now they're invading your weekend.
Go! John and Ken, Saturdays starting at 3.
1237 on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Interesting conversation in the chat room about making panoramas. And that's a great place to go for, you know, more information about any of the things we talk about, because these are just the starting points on the radio show. And then you go in the chat room and they're talking about it and you get a lot of information. Smart people in there. And, of course, our great mods, our moderators, Dan and Mike and Oliver and Sweeks. So you just go to irc.dslextreme.com, or you can go to the website leo.am and you'll get into the chat room, which goes on during the show. And it actually goes on 24/7, but I can only guarantee it's safe and sane during the show. That's when we have the moderators in there. My phone number, 1-800-520-1KFI. I'm going to continue to take calls through 3:30 this afternoon, thereabouts. So please keep the phones ringing. I love hearing from you. Paul in Tustin, you're next on KFI. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for hanging on.
Hey, I've got an interesting paradox here with my mail program. Every time I download a security update from Apple, and by the way, I love your show.
Thank you.
You do a great justice to Apple and to the computer world, not to mention the PC. Anyways, every time I download an upgrade and the security updates mail, I can't reply to people anymore. The only
really?
Way, when I do a reply in my mailbox in the text area, the only way I can type stuff in there is if I don't use a space, if I type the whole word. In other words, yes, I did get your email, thank you, and I will notify you again.
With no spaces.
With no spaces.
That's not right.
The minute I hit the space bar, it stops, and I just get the down key.
Wow. And then
does it get
better after a while?
No, it never does. Eventually.
But why do you say that you have to do the update? I mean, it happens when you do the update.
Well, you know, you go to Apple sends your security update.
Yeah, but I'm saying it must get better, otherwise you wouldn't say it happens when you do the update.
It only does it when it happens with the updates, and I'm not sure if there's something. It could be something that's in the email boxes, or is there?
All I can say is, I do all the updates. I use mail every day. It's never happened to me, so I'm not sure what's wrong.
I've never heard of this.
Yeah, I've never heard of it either. And I take it that the keyboard works fine in every other program.
Absolutely. Everything works fine.
So it's not your keyboard is what I'm saying.
No. It works fine over every other application. And again, keep in mind that if I type everything continuously without any spaces, I can type the whole sentence.
It's just the space bar doesn't work.
It's the space bar.
And if you hit it, nothing happens. Is that the problem?
Right. I just get a dong. In other words, if I receive space, then after that I can't type anything else.
You know, Here's what I would try. I have no idea what's going on, but I mean, that's just bizarre. But what I would do is I would, I think it might be your keyboard definition. And so what I would do is I would open, go to the system preferences and open the international preference. That's where you can choose the language and the keyboard and so forth.
Okay.
And I think what you would probably want to choose is make sure that you are on.
You said go to international.
Yeah. And then input menu.
Okay. Input menu.
And make sure that I think it's U.S. Yeah. U.S. is checked. You know, it might have to do with Unicode. This is because it sounds like what I'm thinking is that there is a keyboard definition issue.
Right.
And so what I want to make sure is that you're using the U.S., plain U.S., not U.S. extended keyboard.
It is. It says U.S. keyboard, okay. And that's the only one that's checked.
And that's the only one that's checked.
Yes.
All right. You know, one of the things that has changed in computers in general is instead of, we used to use ASCII the time, which was an 8-bit way of representing letters. There was a problem. It didn't work for Asian alphabets and any alphabet that needed more than 255 characters. ASCII doesn't work. So the world has moved to something called Unicode, which is a 16-bit designation, gives you 16,000 plus characters. And I'm wondering if this is a Unicode issue on your mail. Let me look at mail and see if there's some preferences in there. That you might want to change. The fact that it's happening only in mail, I think, is significant.
It is, and it's the only computer that does that.
Yeah, no, it's something wrong with that computer. You know, one way on a Mac, it's always a good thing to have a unused extra account. This is true on Windows, too. Have an extra account that you don't use that's vanilla. You haven't configured it or modified it in any way. And you can create it now if you want using the system preference pane, the accounts preference pane. Then log into that account and see if the same thing happens there. If
okay.
It doesn't, then it's something local, which I think it is in this case, to your login. And probably, you know, the traditional Mac troubleshooting would help, which is deleting preferences, holding down the shift key when you boot up. You know, one of the things Windows, or rather Mail, is very good at is that there are a lot of plugins for Mail. Are you using any plugins for Mail at all, or is it just a vanilla?
No. My Mail application is pretty simple. I just use the Mail. That's it. It's very straightforward.
I haven't seen anything like that. I should check MacFixit to see if they have anything. I've been looking at the...
Could it be something on a... could it be a contaminated email?
Well,
I thought of that, but it wouldn't make any difference.
Why would it change everything? Yeah,
I've downloaded the same emails on other computers and nothing happened.
Right. Okay. So that's probably not then. It could be something corrupted, but I think it's not likely in the email. It's something corrupted in the keyboard definition. Are you composing with plain text or rich text? Check the email. Check the mail preferences. Make sure you're composing with plain text. What else could be doing it?
Preferences.
And you might look at the fonts you're using and check that and make sure you're using a pretty traditional font. You know, Helvetica is a good one, or Arial.
I'm using rich text.
Okay, try using plain text.
Okay.
And then I would also make sure, go to fonts and colors, make sure you're using kind of standard fonts, nothing too weird.
Okay.
It may be that the font you're using is somehow damaged and that the space, it can't do a space. See, now once you turn off rich text, that should fix it because you're no longer typing in fonts.
Okay.
So I think try it now. I mean, I think that might actually be the simplest fix.
Let's see.
In which case, it was the font that you had chosen as your composition font might have been damaged. Are you doing it right now?
Yes, I
like this instant feedback.
I'm hitting and actually, interesting enough, too, one of the things that, and I think it's doing the same thing, it won't allow you to reply.
Oh, yeah, I think your mail is just screwed up. best thing to do is delete the preferences to mail. Find all the preferences to mail and just delete them. Those will all be in the preferences folder. They'll usually com.apple.mail, something like that. You got me. Anybody who has an idea, that's a very unusual, weird problem. 1-800-520-1KFI. Well, that's a, I don't want to spend too much time because it's such an unusual problem. I'm not sure it has applicability to many other people. Andy, Redondo Beach, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You've been hanging on for a long time, too. Thank you for your patience, Andy.
Oh, that's okay. Hey, but you got me scared now. I just ordered a new laptop.
Uh-oh.
You said everybody should wait for the Conroe.
No. I just, if you're inclined to get the highest performance, those new Duo, the Core 2s, will be a higher performance. They're nice. But don't worry. No, I mean, I ordered a new laptop just about a month ago. It's fine. Don't worry.
Okay, cool.
Don't freak out.
The real question I'm calling is, I got 120 gigs of music that I just got organized, and
wow.
I want to get exactly how I want on my 60 gig.
Wow.
iPod. So how can I back up what's on my iPod so that's safe and secure? So that, you know, I don't have to go through and pick out the songs I don't want.
Because you're no longer syncing, right?
Oh, yeah, but you know how you unselect the songs that you want,
right,
and everything?
Right. So you're no longer, essentially, you're no longer backing up your iPod because you're only, everything that's on your iPod's on your hard drive.
Yeah, but there's double that.
And on your hard drive, not on your iPod.
Right, but if my iPod fails, then I just need to redo it.
You just plug it in and then it'll copy all the files it copied last time.
Oh.
The thing you have to worry about is not your iPod. It's that hard drive with 120 gigs of songs. As long as you're doing... Now, it's possible to put stuff on your iPod that you aren't... that isn't backed up. And that is if you turn off the automatic update feature of the iPod.
Okay.
But you haven't done that. Well, when you plug in the iPod, does it launch iTunes and copy files over? Make sure it's all...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you're fine. That means there's nothing on your iPod that's not on the hard drive.
Okay.
So you have, in fact, everything that's on your iPod, you have a copy on the hard drive. The problem is, it doesn't go the other way. Not everything on your hard drive is on the iPod.
Okay, so now I'm getting this new laptop. Can I copy what's on my iPod to the laptop?
You can.
Oh.
You can. And you can't do it with iTunes, because iTunes is a one-way street, and that's kind of a primitive copy protection.
Uh-huh.
That is built in for, Apple put it in there. It doesn't stop anybody. It's just a way of doing it. There are a number of really good transfer utilities programs that let you access the iPod from Windows. VPod is a good one. Just do a Google for VPOD, and what it does is it sees the iPod and allows you to copy them over. I'll tell you what. There's so many good ones.
Oh, good.
Fewer good ones for the Mac, for Windows, than there are for the Mac, but there are plenty of choices of free programs. You just can't use iTunes to do this. You have to use a third-party program, because iTunes, you know, if you think about it, your iPod is a wonderful piracy tool. You've got 60 gigs of songs. You could, if it were that easy, you just bring it over to a friend's house, say, here, have my entire music collection.
Right.
So they make it so that, the average Joe using iTunes can't do it.
Yeah.
But it turns out any idiot can just go and download a program that'll do it, you know, for free. And that's what you want. But in a way, if you think about it, your iPod is a great backup device for your hard drive. It's got a copy of all the songs on your hard drive. You, and I think more and more this is going to be the case, you have more than 60 gigs, so you can't put it all on your iPod. So really what you need to back up is not your iPod. You need to back up your hard drive. There's more on your hard drive is a superset of what's on your iPod, not the other way around. Now, if you turn off automatic updating, and you can do that in the iPod preferences, and just drag files onto your iPod, you can go from computer to computer and drag music songs onto your iPod. At that point, your iPod will contain songs from a variety of different sources you may not have copies anywhere else of. Or you could erase what's on your hard drive and your iPod would be the only copy of it. At that point, it does become important to back up your iPod. Now your iPod's the only copy. But most people, the way they use iTunes is they sync their iPod to iTunes, which means you have two copies of everything. Does that make sense? 1249, 11 away from 1. What's your favorite iPod copying utility for Windows or Mac? I'd like to hear from you. 1-800-520-1KFI. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
Hot, fresh, John and Ken. Now open weekends. John and Ken, Saturdays starting at 3.
1256 on KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The chat rooms had come up with a couple of great Mac programs. FPOD, E-P-H-P-O-D, and SharePod. Both free. SharePod's a one I really like. It actually can be used instead of iTunes on Windows machines to access your iPod. And a good idea is to keep a copy of this and maybe Snooty, which is an excellent Windows program for iPods, on your iPod hard drive. So if you get to somebody's house and you want to steal a lot of music, you just, I guess I shouldn't put it that way. Well, let me think of another way to put it. Oh, yeah, you're at the beach house and you want to copy your songs off onto the new computer. You've got the software on the iPod that you need to access the iPod. And you just copy it over, or in some cases, you can even run it off of them. So, let's see. Do I have time for another call? I'm going to try to get a quick one in. We've got,
Diana.
Diana. What line is Diana on? I don't see.
Four.
Line four. Hey, Diana. Welcome to KFI.
Here.
There you are. Hey. Hi. How you doing? What can I do for you today?
Leo, under my computer, I have a folder that whenever I save anything to my documents, it saves there also.
Ah. What's the name of that folder?
It's called Shin Family's Documents.
Yes.
And I've tried to delete that folder, and if I delete that, my documents go with it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That's because it is my documents. It's an alias. It's got two names. And
okay.
That's the official name is Shin Family Folder. Because that's your login. When you log into your computer, that's what it is, right? Shin Family and then the password?
Actually, no.
Oh, it's not. Oh, well, now you got me.
Part of the problem is that one of my daughter's techie friends installed an additional drive. And
okay.
Windows XP Professional. And he misspelled the family name one place, and then so he put in another spelling of it.
Okay. Yeah, I understand. Okay.
Needless to say, I've got you know, I'm
got a mess.
Up my yeah.
Uh-huh. That's why you don't call the geek down the street, by the way, because they tend to do that kind of thing, and they do it with the best intentions. It's not that they're trying to mess you up, but these things happen. Is the Shin Family Folder the misspelled or the properly spelled name?
It's properly spelled, but I think it's different from what my login screen is.
Well, be honest, as long as everything's working and you're able to copy stuff over there, it sounds like it is just, my documents isn't really a folder. I really don't like how Microsoft does this, but they have these pseudo folders. They look like folders, behave like folders, except they're not. And I think that that's what's happened is that it's essentially got two different representations on your hard drive. But it is the same folder. It's not exactly a shortcut because if you delete it, as you pointed out, it deletes the real folder. Just ignore it. Leave it there. Let it continue. And when you reinstall Windows, then you can fix it. But I think unless there's a problem with it, I would keep it the way it is. Incidentally, Microsoft's released a very interesting new program I'll tell you about in the next hour called a Windows Private Folder, which I think is a really good idea, something people have wanted for a while. But we have to run. News is next. It's 12:59. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Jessica Rosenthal's in the KFI News Center.
Southern California weather from KFI. Heat advisory is out for Ventura and LA County mountains and valleys. We'll have sunny skies, highs in the 70s at the beaches, 80s and 90s for metro LA and Orange counties, up to 106 in the valleys. It's 87 right now in Fullerton, 80 in Laguna Beach, 86 in Hollywood, and 77 in Westchester. KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. 107, I'm Jessica Rosenthal, KFI News.
Thank you, Jessica. 107 KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. When Diana was asking about this strange folder, it reminded me that there is a new Microsoft freebie that I think is a really good idea. And I think Microsoft thinks everybody will think it's a really good idea. And it's a very clever plan, a ploy on their part to get everybody to install Windows Genuine Advantage. So let me talk about it a little bit here. WGA, we call it, Windows Genuine Advantage. It's an anti-piracy program that Microsoft instituted just after Service Pack 2 came out. It's a little pro. You probably noticed it when you run Windows Update at some point. It said, well, I need to install WGA. And you install it. It's a little program runs in your system and validates that you, in fact, own a legitimate copy of Windows. It doesn't work, by the way, very well. In fact, according to some reports, as many as 1 in 5 PCs, legitimate PCs, fail the test. I'm not sure if that's true, but I've certainly seen a number of them. Could well be 1 in 5. On the other hand, it's Microsoft's a fairly unobtrusive way of validating that people aren't stealing Windows. That's a problem for Microsoft. People buy one copy and install it on 20 machines, or worse, they will not even buy the copy. They'll borrow a friend's copy and install it on their machines. Now, you would have thought this Windows authentication that they've added would have solved that, but that's pretty easy to get around, particularly since it's not on all copies of Windows. If you buy a seat license version of Windows, a multi-license version of Windows, there's no authentication built into it. Can't be. The Windows that comes with many PCs doesn't have it for the same reason. So they put this Windows Genuine Advantage validation check in there. And if you run Windows Update and you try to download software from Microsoft, anything but critical updates, it'll run and it'll stop you if you don't validate. And Microsoft wants everybody to install this. A lot of people have avoided installing it. So what are they doing? Well, they're giving you some cool free stuff you get if you install Windows Genuine Advantage. If you go to Microsoft.com/genuine/offers, they're up front. They say, here are some free offers. There's a soccer scoreboard. A little late for that. There's a karaoke rummy Windows Defender. Now, that's worth it. The Media Center karaoke plugin. Okay, I'll pass on that. But the one I think will be useful is something new. It's called Microsoft Private Folder. It allows you to create a folder. You get one password-protected folder on each login called My Private Folder. It just, by copying files into it, it makes them private. It locks them up, and nobody else can access it. It's actually a good idea. I get asked that all the time. How do I make a folder that my kids can't get into? So this would solve that. But beware, you've got to have Windows Genuine Advantage installed. And as usual, with most copy protection, the only people it stops and slows down are honest people. Because if you do a Google search on bypass WGA, for instance, you'll find a dozen sites, more, hundreds of sites, that tell you the very easy steps involved to just disable that warning, just turn it off so you don't see it anymore. Now, I'm looking at the people in the chat room. Maybe that 20% number, that 1 in 5, is accurate because Make It Worse, for instance, says, I had 4 legitimate XP boxes, one of which was illegal according to Windows Genuine Advantage. Another said something very similar. So Windows Genuine Advantage is not working very well. But the good news is it's easy to turn off. Much to Microsoft's chagrin. You know, in fact, it's really interesting, this battle between copy protection and pirates. And what happens is, when these companies, the Motion Picture Association of America, or the Recording Industry Association of America, or the record labels, the movie companies, when they start using these onerous copy protection techniques, all they really do is create the exact opposite of what they'd want to do. They create a culture of thieves. By making normal, honest people have to get around this stuff, they're essentially teaching us that it's okay to steal. And here's how, you know, learn how, because you need to if you want to do the legitimate, honest stuff that you want to do. If you've got a copy of Windows legitimately that won't pass WGA, you can spend hours on hold with Microsoft and get no satisfaction. Or you can go online on Google in about 30 seconds, find out how to disable it. Find out how to crack it. It's teaching normal, honest people how to crack things. It has the exact opposite of the intended consequence. Pirates never have trouble. Pirates get through this stuff like butter. But now we're all becoming pirates. We're all learning how to be pirates. It's how we have to be. if we want to, you know, simply use the music we bought, the movies we bought, in ways that we want to use them. And it doesn't take long. There are many more of us than there are of them. There is no way to make an encryption system that's foolproof. They'll all get cracked eventually. Why? Well, unlike email encryption, which isn't crackable, or secure transactions, which isn't crackable, there's a little flaw in all of the systems that the movie companies, the record companies have to use. In order for a DVD player to have to be able to play an encrypted DVD, it has to have the key built into the DVD player, right? It has to know. And who owns a DVD player? We do. So they're giving us the key. And it's just a matter of time and ingenuity before somebody figures out how to get that key out of there. It didn't take long for DVD Yon to decrypt DVDs. The guy was a high school student, 16 years old, but he figured it out because every DVD player has to be able to play a DVD. Every software player has to be able to decrypt it. You're giving us the keys at the same time as you're hiding them. So the movie industry has a very big interest in creating a solid encryption technology for the new DVD. They get a second chance, right? The new high def and Blu-ray DVDs. They're going to get a second chance. They blew it with CSS. It was too easy to break. It was broken almost immediately. People have been able to copy DVDs for a long time. Here's your chance. And they said, we're going to come up with a scheme no one will crack. They've cracked it already. How long has HD DVD been out? Less than a month. And it's been cracked. It's kind of a kooky crack, and I think it's the first of probably many ways to crack it, but it works. It turns out if you're playing back a high-def DVD on a computer, you could play it a frame at a time and hit print screen each frame, and it will capture each frame and then stitch it all back together to make a movie. Now, you might say, well, that's who's going to sit there one at a time? There's millions of frames in a movie. Well, nobody, but it's very easy to write a program that does this for you automatically. Now, I don't know if that's I don't know if that's the final stage, but it's a point. The point is less than a month. Movie industry put every effort it could into making this stuff completely secure. They have a huge investment in it. I mean, they're giving you super good quality video. They're giving you video good enough you could show in a movie theater if you could steal it. So they had every interest in making sure this was uncrackable. Less than a month, it's been cracked. You can't do it. You can't do it. Just give up. You're training a whole generation of pirates. We don't want to be pirates. People don't want to be pirates. I really believe people want to buy music and buy movies and pay for this stuff. If you love music, of course you want to pay for it. Of course you want to buy it. In fact, I think that most adults now spend more for movies, music, and other entertainment than we've ever spent. What's your cable bill? We don't mind paying. We do pay. So why are you treating us like thieves? And why are you training us to be thieves? It's a mistake. Donna, Yorba Linda, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thanks for your very, very patient
sure thing. I have several computers in my home, and for years and years, we've always used Norton antivirus, and I'm not happy with that, and I've listened to you talking about the different antivirus programs. I got a new Dell recently that has PC Cylon 2006, mm-hmm. and it seems to run pretty smoothly for me. It doesn't bog the computer down, and I wanted your thoughts about that, and then also, I saw something called Windows Live OneCare, and I'd never heard of this. I wondered if you could comment on that.
I will. So PC Cylon's from Trend Micro, very well-known, established, and I think high-quality antivirus.
Sure. Okay,
nothing wrong with it. You got it free already. Keep it.
Okay.
It is tending to have the same problem. Panda, PC Cylon, Norton, and McAfee all have this problem because they're so well-known, they're so established, they're bloatware. You know, what happens is you want the PC Magazine review to have check marks in all the boxes. You're trying to sell against Norton, right? So you make sure you got all those features. So if Norton does it, you do it. So they all are bloated. But if you can live with it, if it's, you know, what I would suggest is look at what you can turn off. Don't run everything that it came with. But it's the core antivirus of PC Cylon is actually a very good antivirus.
Okay. Oh, good.
So nothing wrong with that. Now, this is interesting. Microsoft has decided to get into this game.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're offering something called OneCare. I think it's $50 for up to three machines for a year. That's a good price because you get not only an antivirus, you get a beefed up Windows firewall, and you get an anti-spyware solution.
Mm-hmm.
And in theory, and I've been running it for a while, you can run it free for 3 months. I've been running it for a while. It, you know, it checks your system regularly. It keeps it all up to date. And because it's Microsoft, you know, presumably they know how to make this run efficiently in the background and not mess up Windows. I'm not guaranteeing that they do, but I would think they do. Both the anti-spyware and antivirus engines were written outside of Microsoft and acquired. Microsoft bought them. Then, after a period of time, integrated them into Windows. I think OneCare is probably, for a lot of, especially novice users, I think it's a good solution. I think it's something Microsoft had to do. Some say, well, look, Microsoft's profiting on the insecurity of their operating system. If they'd just written it right in the first place, we wouldn't need OneCare.
True.
There's something to be said for that. But it's not expensive. For a lot of people, it will be a no-brainer. It's a very easy install. It's just a button that you click, essentially, when you get your new Windows machine. I suspect it will get better and better because Microsoft has a strong vested interest in making it the best possible, right?
Yeah. Now, you said you could get 3 months of it free. Now, how does that work?
I think if you go to, let me see if I can find it, but if you go to the site, there's a free offer. You can download it and run it for free for a...
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I did that just because I wanted to take a look at it. So I put it on one of my Windows machines. One of my newer ones. Actually, I put it on my Mac, believe it or not. I had a new installation of Windows on the Mac, and I thought, well, here's a good chance to try it. And I've been happy with it. Now, some of the reports are that it isn't the best antivirus out there, and that may be true. You know, it's new. So it takes a while for an antivirus really to become as powerful as it's going to be. You are a PC Cilium, so don't worry about it. But when PC Cilium expires, call me then, or we'll talk about it. I think by then, OneCare will be a very good choice.
One other thing, there's some sort of virus bulletin, is it called,
yeah,
where you can go and you can check out things like
yes.
this? Is that a pretty reliable source?
They are absolutely reliable. They are the biggest and best known independent testing body. They've been around for the longest. VBTN.com. I can't remember. Just do a Google for virus bulletin, but they're very
virus
good.
Bulletin.
Yeah.
Cool.
Highly
Thanks.
Recommend them. The problem with them, in fact, a lot of these sites, is they don't give you kind of side-by-side comparisons.
Mm.
What they do is monthly, they have a suite of viruses. They have a collection of tens of thousands of viruses, and they'll run each antivirus and its current signature database against those. If it gets all of them, it gets the 100% award. You're looking for an antivirus that has had 100% award almost always for the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't, then that's not a good choice.
Heuristic?
Oh, that's a good question, too. Now, one of the things that... Well, I'll tell you what. Hold on a second, and I'll explain it, because we have to take a break for some commercial. I'll tell you, do you want me to explain to you in person, or are you willing to take your answer on the air?
Oh, no, just in person. It's
all right. As long as you've been holding on for an hour and a half, I might as well talk to you some more. Well, I'm going to put you on hold one more minute, okay? And then we'll come a little more than a minute, but a couple of minutes. And then I'll explain heuristics. This is actually a fascinating subject. About how antiviruses and a good antivirus will work. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio, 121.
John Ziegler, evenings right after John and Ken, 7 to 10.
KFI, AM 640.
KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. And by the way, somebody pointed out in the show notes, and I couldn't agree more. I was talking about Microsoft's private folder. And they pointed out, you don't have to sign up for Windows Genuine Advantage just to get that. I mean, if you really want good encryption, TrueCrypt.org, and I couldn't agree more. What a great program. It's absolutely free. It's open source. It really is the only sensible way to use encryption as an open source encryption standard. Because you know whether they're doing it right or not. TrueCrypt.org, and I should have mentioned that. Absolutely. When I was talking about the folder it makes sense for me for a novice user of Windows doesn't want to know anything and install TrueCrypt and go through all of that. At least gives you some modicum of protection. But you're right. I mean, why sign up for Windows Genuine Advantage if you don't have to? Problem is, if you're getting a new PC, you already are signed up. It's on it. There's nothing you can do about that. And, you know, it is a free program and it's from Microsoft. If you want to make a comment or read the show notes, they're there for you. Just go to the website, kfiam640.com, and Click my name, Leo Laporte, under shows. If you're listening live, you'll see my picture right there, and you click that. That takes you to my page at KFIAM640.com, and then the link under my picture that says official website. That's where the show notes live. That's leo.am. And this is Saturday's show, 263 for July 8th. You'll find lots of information there and a chance to comment. There's a comment box at the bottom of every page. 129 now, Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFIAM640. I'm going to talk with... I really feel bad. Poor Donna's got to hold on a little longer. We're going to talk about advanced heuristics and other features to look for in an antivirus program, but we do have to take a break for news. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio at 129. Jessica Rosenthal's in the KFI News Center.
Nighttime is the right time for John Ziegler. Monday night, 7 to 10.
KFI AM 640.
138. KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. We're doing a little psychological experiment here, and I want to thank Donna from Yerba Linda for participating. We just want to see how long we could keep somebody on hold before they actually take out a shotgun. You're alive still?
I am, and I'm a New Yorker. New Yorkers aren't supposed to be terribly patient. But.
You're very patient. Thank you so much, Don, and I apologize. I know this is the Bataan Death March of radio shows.
Well, it's not quite a gulag, but it's there.
Oh, my goodness. Anyway, you're very patient. But it's such a good question. I really did want to address it, and I didn't want to do it in the short break that we had in between.
Okay.
We're talking about antiviruses, and you've asked some really good questions about this and that. And by the way, we have some more links, some interesting links from members of the chat room. For instance, a site called virustotal.com, which is an online virus scan. There are a lot of good resources, but let me talk about the specific question you asked, which is heuristics. And there are a couple of different ways antiviruses work. Of course, if you've used an antivirus, you know they have to be updated. What they do is they download what they call virus signatures. And a virus signature is actually kind of primitive once you understand it. It's just a short string of text that is found in the virus. Now, if you do a long enough, you kind of have to balance it. It has to be short enough so that because there's 20 or 30,000 of them in this download, so it has to be fairly short, but it has to be long enough that it would kind of be a unique fingerprint, that if this data appeared in a file, it would be that virus. So that's a balancing act between the size of the file, the length of time it takes to scan, and the false positives. You don't want an antivirus to scream fire if there isn't a virus. So that's how most of them work with these signature files. In fact, some of them, that's the only way they work. Kaspersky, which is a very well-known, very good antivirus, only uses signature files. But most antiviruses now also have some smarts. They sit there in the system tray watching what's going on, looking for virus-like activity, and that's called heuristics. It is merely watching and looking for virus behavior. You know, a program that tries to modify the system files or tries to hide itself or any variety of activities. If the heuristics are well written, this is becoming a more and more important part of an antivirus, because nowadays viruses spread so rapidly. You could be a signature-based scanner when viruses came in via floppy disk, because you just scan everything that comes in. But now, because of email, viruses spread so quickly. They can literally spread worldwide in 24 hours. They get to your computer faster than the updates do. It takes about a day for an antivirus company to get to find the virus, figure it out, make a update, and push that update out to you. That means you're vulnerable. The scanner won't find it for the first 24 hours. That's why heuristics become so important. It's a first line of defense. It's imperfect. And by the way, it's tricky because it can also be a cause of a lot of false positives. In fact, most false positives come from heuristics saying, hey, I don't know what's going on, but this program's acting suspicious. And you may see a lot of those warnings.
I was just going to say, and I'm not sure if this is the same thing or if it was spyware, but I have a network in my house, and I try, and sometimes I'm sitting in one room and I want to print to the printer in the other room, and I've noticed occasionally it will not let me do that, and it'll say there's an intrusion coming.
That might well be. That might well be. It could be a firewall. It could be an antivirus. You know, firewalls are even worse in this regard. One of the reasons I tell people it's probably not a good idea to have a software firewall is they tend to be overzealous.
Okay.
Zone alarm, The Windows firewall is not overzealous. It's passive. In fact, it's a lazy firewall. On the other hand, Zone Alarm is like really anxious. Anytime something happens, it really wants to let you know. And hey, there's something going on over here. And after a while, what happens is you get fatigued. You say, I'm not going to pay attention to that. It keeps warning me. It's full of. So that's why I think they're kind of useless, because they give you too much information.
Mm-hmm.
So a good antivirus that has good heuristics. PC Cillin is a good choice. It's fine. I'm a fan of Nod32. That's why I
know
I do their
you
ads, and I think they have very good advanced heuristics. But you've already got PC Cillin, so there's nothing wrong with that.
Okay.
All right.
Excellent.
And OneCare is a dark horse. Currently, I'm not convinced it's as good as the others. I think it will get better, and I bet by the time PC Cillin expires on you in a year. It will be the right way to go.
I have teenage sons, so that's my concern.
Oh, you should be. Yes. No, because that's who brings in this stuff.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. If I go to a house, if they're having trouble, people, you know, my friends often call. They all have teenagers. If I go to a house and they've got teenagers, I know I'm going to see a lot of spyware, a lot of viruses, a messed up machine. And that's, you know, the best thing to do is, if you can, is you keep them, give them your own computer and just keep them off your network, or put a firewall between you and them or something.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
All right. Thank you, Donna. That was the world's longest. You were on hold for almost 2 hours, so you get the prize.
Was it? Oh, well, now I should get something special.
I don't know what I'll give you, but I, you know, hang on the line. I'm going to get one. I'm going to put you on hold one more time. But no. But just so that Rebecca can pick up and get your address, and I'll send you a copy of my book.
Cool.
To thank you.
That was great. Appreciate
thank
it,
you.
Leo.
Appreciate your patience, because I know it's, you know, I talk a lot. And so, and we have a lot of lines, and they get full right at the beginning of the show. And sometimes people do hang on for much of the show, and I apologize for that. Do hang on, though, because I am going to keep taking calls. The show ends in about 15 minutes. Dr. Dina Dell is coming up next, and it's a fresh John and Ken at 3. But I will continue to take calls at 1-800-520-1KFI. We're pre-taping for a later show, so please do continue to keep those phones ringing. And I will attempt to get to everybody before the end of the day. I'm pretty sure I'll be able to. Like this fellow, Brian Laguna Niguel. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to KFI.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me. We just got a MacBook, and we've never had a laptop before.
Oh, boy.
And so we just opened the box, and this morning we've been trying to get wireless connection to the internet, and we don't know what to do to get that.
It's usually pretty easy with a Mac. Do you have a Wi-Fi access point?
Don't know.
Oh, well, you won't get a wireless connection unless you do. That would be your problem, my friend.
Well, we have PCs, and they're hooked up to the Linksys system.
But the Linksys, is it wireless? Does it have antennas on it?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, then it's wireless. Now, the first thing you want to make sure is that it's on. That this is, if you've never used the Wi-Fi, it may not be on. You can actually turn it off on these Linksys. So if you've been using it hardwired, it sounds like the PCs are plugged into it.
I have a PC in another room that's wireless connection.
Oh, okay. So you do have Wi-Fi. So you have a working Wi-Fi.
Right.
Okay. So then the first thing, generally, when you turn on the Mac and, you know, you get the little song and it says, tell us your name and all that stuff, it will automatically look for your Wi-Fi and log you in.
Okay.
So you've gone through that process already, the registration?
Well, it doesn't seem to be doing it. You know, we opened it actually last week. We're in a hotel, and we got it, and we hooked it up to the hotel.
So
we
already did that.
We know we can get online, but we don't know.
Yeah.
You know, we just want to go to Starbucks and use it.
Yeah.
And,
so here's the thing. On a Mac, and all the new Macs have Wi-Fi built in, because there's Wi-Fi on it, there's a little icon up in the upper right of the menu bar. It looks like a triangle with lines. And that's your little wireless networking doohickey.
Okay.
If you click on it, it's a menu.
Okay.
And it takes a little bit after you first turn it on and everything, but a minute after you turn it on, it will have looked for all the wireless access points and made a list of them in that menu. So you click on the little triangle. And by the way, the number of bars in the triangle tells you how strong the signal is. If you get no bars, you're not getting a signal, or you're not connected to anybody. If you get 5 bars, you've got a very strong signal. Now, in general, you know, I don't know how it is in Laguna Niguel, but in most, I imagine it's true there. Certainly, it's true most areas where there are a number of people around. You probably can get 3 or 4 different signals. So what you want to do is you click on that icon, the little triangle icon, and drop down the menu, and you'll see a list, and you're going to look for yours. Now, if you haven't named your Linksys, it'll be called Linksys.
Okay, we might have seen that.
So you want to find out what the name is.
Okay.
It's a good idea to rename them because they're all, you know, Linksys. Some wag once said the number one internet service provider in the U.S. is Linksys because everybody just steals everybody's Wi-Fi. And if you don't rename them, they're called Linksys. So if you haven't renamed it, it sounds like you probably haven't, unless you've got a geek in the house who's not around right now.
No.
No, all right. So it's probably called Linksys. So drop down that menu, you'll see Linksys selected.
Okay.
What will then happen, if you've put a password on it, it'll ask you for the password. If it's unsecured Wi-Fi that anybody can get on, it'll just join it. And all of a sudden, that triangle, you'll see, if you're near the access point, you'll see it will turn into a series of four or five black bars.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you're online.
Okay.
You open your browser, and it should pop up. It takes a few seconds. Here's the process it has to go through. First, it has to find it. You've selected it. It has to announce itself to the wireless access point. Say, hey, here I am. Give me an IP address. Give me a number. It'll assign an IP address. The Mac will get it. It says, okay, give me some more information. I need to know what the DNS servers, et cetera. It signs all that stuff. And it says, okay, great. I'm ready. And that takes about 30 seconds to a minute. So after you select Linksys, wait for, you know, half a minute, and then open your browser. And you should be online.
Okay. All right.
It's really simple.
I know we messed around this morning. I think we kind of found that. That part you told me to go, but nothing really seemed to work. So
right. It's easier on the Mac than it is on any other computer. You just have to make sure you choose the right access point. By the way, I would recommend that you turn on WPA encryption, WPA protection in your Linksys router. When you do that, you'll be asked to choose a password, choose a nice long random string, but remember it, write it down. And then the next time you try to use the wireless internet on your PC or on your Mac, it'll say, whoa, I need a password. It's secured. Whoa. What's the password? You'll enter it. You only have to enter it once. It will remember it from then on. But by doing so, you've encrypted the Wi-Fi so nobody can get on your network. Nobody can steal anything from you. Nobody can borrow wireless networking unless you give them the password. 149, 11 away from 2, Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
KFI News, fueled by the worldwide resources of Fox News. KFI, AM 640.
155 on KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Talking about upcoming cruises in the chat room. I've been doing more and more of these, and I have to say I love them. I know Bill Handel goes on them. He was my inspiration. But I go on Geek Cruises at geekcruises.com. And they're regularly scheduled cruises on Holland America, but we do computer conferences aboard them. And I've got one coming up in August. It's a digital photography cruise, but there's also a chess cruise along with it. And I'm a kind of amateur duffer chess player, and I'm looking forward to polishing some of my skills on that. And then there's Mac Mania 5, which is coming up in October, November. That's going to be a lot of fun. And I just signed on for a Windows Vista cruise in February. PC World is going to be sponsoring this, and I'll give you the details later. And I was just talking in the chat room about Vista, and you know, I don't like to do beta programs. I mean, it's not a good way to review software, because especially with Windows betas, the program changes quite a bit often by the time it ships. I think Beta 2 is probably pretty close to how Vista is going to be, but I haven't really been tempted to install it. I'm kind of waiting. When they get to the what they call the release candidate, which is a version of Windows, it'll be probably the next version that comes out, a version of Windows or of any program that is, they feel, fairly close to the release. There might be one or two issues, and they want you to bang on it to find if there are any issues. They'll usually do a one or two release candidates and then go to what they call the Gold Master or RTM. Release to manufacture. That is the final disk. That's the one that's going to go out. Microsoft's probably on track to get that release to manufacture out by October, September, maybe. They, I know, want to get the big customers, the big business customers, the corporate customers, a final version by maybe October, November. And then in order to get it into the stores and into new machines by their target date of January or February of next year, they really do have to get it out by November or December. It takes a little while to print them out and put them on the machines. So the cruise is in February. What I'm hoping, and I'm going to be doing a bunch of Vista stuff, a couple of classes on Vista security, Vista software gems, migrating to Vista class. So I've got to get pretty Vista savvy before then. I'm hoping, this is what my prayer is, there'll be a great Dell machine with the Conroe chip, the Core 2 Duo, and Vista pre-installed probably by December. And that's what I'm holding out for. Then I'll become a Vista expert. There'll be plenty of time over the holidays to do that. I'm out of time here, but I am going to keep taking calls. So keep the phone calls going. 1-800-520-1KFI. I'll keep answering questions till 3 or 3:30 at that number. Meanwhile, Dr. Dina Dale's up next, and I'll be back tomorrow, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. to talk about high tech with you. So please join me every Saturday and Sunday, 11 to 2. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Stay cool. Have a great Saturday afternoon. It's 1:59. Jessica Rosenthal's in the KFI News Center. Well, that's it for this edition of the Tech Guy on KFI. Thanks so much for listening. If you're ever in the Southern California area, I hope you'll listen live on the radio every Saturday and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on KFI AM 640. You can also listen on the internet anytime at KFIAM640.com. Archives of older shows are available online on my website. That's leo.am. Click the audio archives button. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast, which is leo.am/podcasts/KFI. My thanks to Howard Bailey for providing the theme music for this show. You can listen to Howard's music at soundclick.com. Thanks to DSL Extreme for providing the bandwidth. Of course, first of all, thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time on KFI.